Welcome to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. Talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate. Bringing you enlightened discussions with authors, creatives, innovative business and health professionals, and ordinary people living extraordinary lives. Sharing their expertise and life stories. Making a difference, one word at a time. Now here's your host, Vicki St. Clair.
Welcome, welcome. Well, today I have three very different guests for you. They have three very different backgrounds and different stories. Joining me first, Lisa Lutz, a former PI turned best-selling novelist and author of the Spellman series. Later in the show, we'll talk with psychiatrist and memoirist David Kirkpatrick in praise of strong women. And we'll also talk with one of America's top executive coaches and speakers on mojo. So if you've been feeling less mojo and a little more no-go lately, you'll want to stay with us. And Marshall Goldsmith is going to join me and tell us how to find it, get it, and keep it. We're talking about mojo. But first, I'm pleased to welcome Lisa Lutz to the show. She's the creative force behind this best-selling Spellman series. She's been nominated for both an Edgar and McCavity Award, and a motion picture is currently in development with Paramount Studios for her New York Times bestselling The Spellman Files. The latest in her series is The Spellman's Strike Again. Lisa, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Pleasure. And first of all, I forgot to ask you before the show, is it Lutz, Lutz? How do you say your name?
I say Lutz, but Lutz. Some people have told me I pronounce it wrong.
Okay. I was kind of coming from the Germanic thing there with Lutz, but okay, we'll call you Lisa Lutz, L-U-T-Z. And,
right.
Yeah. And so I want to talk about the book, but before we get into that, I want to talk a little bit about your background, because you've had a very interesting background, and I'm sure this helps you as a writer of fiction. You by your own terms, said you did a whole bunch of different jobs. One of them was a PI job. Tell us a little bit about how you went to three different universities, apparently, but didn't end up with a bachelor's degree. So you're kind of finding yourself, it sounds, experimenting with a lot of different things.
Yeah, I mean, I saw school as a way for me to write, have free time to write. And so I just, you know, amassed student loan debt, not really thinking about it at the time. And then I'd skip class and write. Mm-hmm. I don't recommend it for anyone.
No.
Kids, that's wrong. But that's how I worked it. And at one point when I was in school, I worked part-time at a PI firm for about two and a half years.
A place you said that was full of hugs and paranoia. Tell us a little bit about it.
It really was. I actually later worked for a relative, and there was, I don't think my uncle ever hugged me, but at this office, the first day on the job, the woman who hired me, Pamela, she gave me this big warm hug and called me her little angel. And within a few weeks, they threw me a surprise birthday party. It was just, there was a lot of affection, a lot of warmth, and they were also like, you know, really paranoid. It was always mm-hmm. like, did you shred that? Who called? What did he say? Well, no. What exactly did he say? And there were a few times where we had to keep the doors locked. And when I'd ask why, they were very shady with their answers.
Now, you started out as a screenwriter. You actually had a film made, but I guess the process was pretty tortuous for you, right?
Yeah. Well, I wrote my first screenplay when I was 21, and it was called Plan B, although it wasn't called that then. And I rewrote it for 10 years, probably 25 drafts of the same script, maybe more. And I worked mostly for free the whole time. And then when it was finally made, it was pretty bad. And when I say pretty bad, I screened it for my mother. And when we were done, she said, wow, that was annoying.
Oh, dear. Okay. Well, hence the odd jobs, because you had to, you know, keep yourself going during this time.
But exactly.
You're working for this private investigative firm, and you did actually do a little bit of PI work yourself. And this sparked an idea for another screenplay, which then turned into a novel. So tell us a little bit about how that came about.
Yes, it was years after I had left the job when I came up with the idea of writing a novel, a kind of mystery novel, I thought at the time, about a family of private investigators. And I, of course, thought it would be very cinematic, so I wrote it as a screenplay, but after my failure with Plan B, no one would read it. And, you know, I took a few years to think about what to do next. At the time, I was in L.A. working at my uncle's CPA practice. I used to say I stapled for a living. And I decided that I couldn't quite give up. And even though I had never thought about writing a novel before, I knew that the screenplay world was sort of dead to me. It wasn't going to happen. So I thought, well, let me just give this a try. And I did. And oddly enough, it worked out. And now I'm, you know, four books in.
Right. And it's a mystery series. It's quite comic. This made me kind of surprised me because you said the whole time you worked at the PI firm, we read all these PI books and mysteries, but there, when you were actually working as a PI person, there were no mysteries to solve.
No, there were none at all. It was sort of like your job was to, if you even did surveillance, and most of the time you were in the office on a computer just looking up someone's background, you know, seeing if they had any criminal records and stuff like that. But let's say you were doing something exciting like surveillance. You would follow someone and see what they were doing, and then you would report about what they were doing. But nobody ever got in a fist fight. We didn't solve any murders. There were no legitimate, fictional-type mysteries that we solved. Mm. And I asked all my coworkers if that ever happened. They're like, no, it doesn't happen.
So tell us how you evolved a mystery series from this then.
Well, I knew that I really wanted to steer clear from the murders and the blackmail. Well, there's blackmail in my books, but it's between family members.
Figures.
Right. But I wanted to show the more plausible world of the private investigators. However, if you write about a family of PIs and you don't have some element of mystery in it, it's not going to fly. So I realized that just basic human behavior is constantly mysterious to me. I walk down the street and I always see things that don't make sense. Like, for instance, in the alley where my front door is, unfortunately, I was walking down the street and I just saw a hospital gown discarded by the side of the alley. And I thought, that's a mystery. A hospital gown? How does that end up there?
Right, right. Sets the wheels in motion there.
Exactly. So I was more interested in just the mysteries of human behavior and figuring out a way to make something much more simple, much more mysterious.
Now, Isabel Spellman is the protagonist of your book. So tell us a little bit about her and a little bit about the new story in the series.
Right. Well, Isabel, I like to think of as a recovering delinquent. She was a very, very difficult adolescent, even very difficult child. And it's taken the family a while to, accept that she's grown up a bit. I don't know that she'll ever grow up completely, but in the book, The Spellman Strike Again, which is the fourth in this series, she's finally, back in the family business and sort of holding her own. She is, however, trying to take down their rival PI, Rick Harkey, who really is a bad guy. And she is also being blackmailed by her mother to go on dates with lawyers because of something that happened prom night 1994, if that says anything about how this family works. So she is dating lawyers, and I highly recommend people visit the website litidate.com, where Isabel finds lawyers, high-quality lawyers. And
there you go.
And Ray Spellman is trying to free a man who has been wrongly incarcerated named Levi Schmidt. So she starts a whole campaign. Ray, by the way, is Isabel's much, much younger sister, who has never had any problem with the family business and has embraced it wholeheartedly. Mm-hmm. So Ray is trying to free Schmidt, and also there's a mystery involving a missing butler. And so Isabel has her friend become an undercover butler and check out the goings-on in a Mr. Winslow's home.
Now, do you deliberately try to be funny, or does this just naturally come to you when you're writing?
I don't know that it's exactly natural, but it always seems like a struggle, and every time I start a book, I think, there's no way I'm going to make this funny. But I think things happen, and eventually especially with these characters and the dynamics between them, I always hope that I can find the joke.
Mm. So what's the writing process for you like, Lisa? I've heard you describe your lead character we just talked about, Izzy Spellman, as a cross between Nancy Drew, when Nancy Drew meets Dirty Harry. And you said your favorite description of her is Nancy Drew with a bottle of bourbon, I think it was, inside of her. Tell us a little bit about the writing process, how that all comes together for you.
I mean, the Spellmans came to me in like a 2 to 3 week period where I envisioned the idea first, and I realized that for a family to be suspicious of one another, I needed them to have a good reason for it. And so then I created Isabel, and I created her backstory. And then some things, you know, sometimes you need to, when you're writing, know more than you tell. And so that's for me the process. It's always like, I need to know who everyone really is, and then I can decide how much I'm going to let the reader know.
Mm. So do you plot all that out physically, or does it come to you kind of organically as you're writing?
It's very organic, and I don't outline exactly ahead of time. I do tend to have story threads that I know I'm going to use, but they'll probably take up no more than a couple pages.
Mm.
And then as I write, I sort of feed my bulletin board with index cards. And as I figure out more things that will happen. A lot of times it's just about jokes, because for me, you know, it's known as a comedic series, and if it's not funny, it's not going to work, because I don't have any life and death scenarios like murder to hang the stories on.
Right, right. And tell us why, I know you went through this journey to become a writer. What was it that compelled you to be a writer? Did you write as a young child?
Yeah, I did. I remember writing more in high school, and it was all dreadful, and it stayed bad. You know, what's funny is, like, I think it took me 10 years or more to find my voice, and it took me a really long time to understand that what I was good at was writing comedic fiction. Before, I was always trying to write more serious fare, and it didn't work, and it was awful. And then when I figured out how much affection I had for jokes, that's when things changed.
Right. And you write about San Francisco a lot because that's where the story's based. You actually said in one article that I read about you that you moved back to San Francisco because it was hard to write about San Francisco from New York or Seattle. I'm not sure how much of that was tongue-in-cheek. But how much is San Francisco a character, and how important is that to you in the book?
I think it became more of a character in later books when I was back. I mean, there are things that you just don't remember. And there's a feel of the city. It's you know, not to be rude to my fellow San Franciscans, but it's truly a city of crazy people. I've never lived in a town where there are more insane people per capita. You know, and you have to get used to it. And you have to learn how to sort of have that relationship where you know, if someone says something crazy to you, to like, respond politely.
You know? Right, right.
It's also hard to park. There's also, as I've said, strange things you find on the ground. I mean, they're just things that I had forgotten about, and it was important to be back there, here,
right.
Wherever I am.
Right, because you've moved quite a bit. I know that.
Yeah.
But that's all, I think, food, you know, food for writers. They need to get out and expand their horizons a little there.
Yeah.
Have you ever got into a situation where you've written yourself into a corner and had to start over?
No, I haven't.
Well, that's good.
I mean, I might have, but I never, you know, I'm very fond of rewriting. I think screenwriting teaches you that you have to rewrite.
Yeah.
So nothing ever feels done to me. And so even when I get to the point where, like, I'm getting notes from my editor, and with the first book, her notes were massive, and she made me change the entire, like, major mystery, quote-unquote, you know, thread in the book. And I didn't react that strongly to her suggestion because I was so accustomed to that. So I don't think I would see myself as painting myself into the corner. I would be like, you know, let's just get some turpentine and
right, right.
Get rid of it.
Do you see another book in this series? I know you want to work on something else, and I read that you like to just focus on one project at a time.
Well, I did write, I took a break from the Spellmans, and during that time, I guess because I didn't tell people what I was working on, people said that it was this book, The Spellman Strike Again, is the last in the series. It actually isn't. I just agreed to write another one, but that won't be out for probably maybe 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
I wrote a more traditional and less traditional crime novel. I collaborated on a crime novel with my ex-boyfriend. Called Heads You Lose, and it's essentially about a collaboration gone wrong.
Mm-hmm. And how did your collaboration on that go? since it's an ex-boyfriend?
Well, since it was, I built into it that we were going to disagree, we were okay. I mean, we did have our moments where I was just like, I cannot believe, you know, he's an ex-poet, So he has no concept of plot whatsoever.
Right.
And so that part could be a little bit frustrating. I'm like, we have a dead body here. Don't you want to find out who killed him?
Right. Now, writers go through a lot of rejection. It doesn't matter what stage of their career in, whether it's critics or editors or publishers. How have you learned to handle rejection over the years? Has it got easier for you?
Well, I mean, yes, of course. With screenwriting, it was 10 years of rejection. So by the time I got the book deal, I mean, it was actually uncomfortable to have it work out. For the first few years, I was just like, this isn't right. I'm used to failure. This is so uncomfortable.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and what was funny was after the book deal happened, one of the agents at my new agency called me because he knew that I was having that experience of not feeling as good as I should feel because it just was so foreign a feeling.
And what did he tell you about that?
I just remember him sort of, he didn't actually give me any advice, but he knew that everyone was congratulating me, and he also knew that I was feeling strange about it, and he just wanted to acknowledge that this was not uncommon.
Mm. That is interesting, isn't it?
Yeah.
We're almost at the end of our segment, Lisa. It's been great talking with you. What do you hope listeners, what do you hope our listeners and readers take away from your books?
You know, I hope that they think it's funny, and I hope it passes the time, but I also hope that they see more to it than just pure entertainment. It's about a family. It's about life. And in this particular book, The Spellman Strike Again, I hope that they pay attention to the Free Schmidt storyline and check out the information we have on my website on the Innocence Project.
And give us your website, please.
It's lisalutz.com.
And Lutz is L-U-T-Z.
Exactly.
LisaLutz.com. And you're coming here to Seattle. I think you're coming tomorrow, you said, right?
Yes, and I will be at the Seattle Mystery Bookshop, 113 Cherry Street, Thursday, April 1st, to celebrate Isabel Spellman's birthday at 12 noon.
Can you believe it's April 1st on Thursday?
No, I can't.
Okay, so April 1st, Thursday, April 1st, at the Seattle Mystery Bookshop at noon, right?
Yes, and there will be cake, I hear.
Oh, well, then I'm going to have to try and get over there.
That would be great.
Cake. Thank you so much for being with us, Lisa. Appreciate your time and good luck.
Thanks a lot, Vicky.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
And please stay with us. When we come back, we'll be talking with psychiatrist and memoirist David Kirkpatrick. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair.
Parkinson's disease affects as many as 1 million people in the United States. At the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, it's our mission to beat this disease. To learn about the Parkinson's Disease Foundation, or if you want to help support our work, visit our website, pdf.org, or call us at 800-457-6676. In the Northwest, contact the Northwest Parkinson's Foundation at nwpf.org.
You're never too old to fulfill your dream, but sometimes we get caught up making a living instead of creating a life. If you put your dream on hold or can't figure out what to do when you grow up, tell us what's getting in your way. I'm Vicky St. Clair, and I'm excited to let you know that we've partnered with dream coach Joyce Chapman to get your questions answered on air. So tell us what's holding you back. Email your questions and challenges to info@conversationslive.net or leave a confidential voicemail at 425-269-4772. And tune into our third Monday Dream Coach series at noon Pacific on KKNW. See more information at conversationslive.net. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair, talk radio to inspire, inform, and stimulate, making a difference, one word at a time.
Want to hear something different from talk radio? The choice is clear. Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is David Kirkpatrick. He is a psychiatrist. He's been a psychiatrist and psychotherapist for over 30 years in Anchorage, Alaska, Vancouver, British Columbia, and Ashland, Oregon. So he's moved around a bit. Today he practices a combination of community health and outpatient psychotherapy in West Vancouver and the Sunshine Coast, and currently lives in West Vancouver. Welcome to the show, David Kirkpatrick.
Vicky, my pleasure.
And you've written a memoir, but it's not called The Story of David or My Life. It's called In Praise of Strong Women. So tell us about that.
Very good opening question. I hadn't planned it for it to be a memoir, but it's and what it is kind of a memoir seen through the lens of strong women, seen through my appreciation and perspective of them. I originally put my grief over the loss of my wife, Betsy, in Oregon back in 1991 into a story about her life, and it was somewhat comforting. And then I thought, well, Betsy was really strong, but so was my mother. So what about my third-grade sweetheart, Jeannie? And then stories kind of grew
right.
And crystallized over that time with the help of a very good editor up here in Seashelt.
Now, what does a strong woman mean to you? You're not talking weightlifting here, but talk about some of the attributes that you see in a strong woman.
Quite a few attributes, and some of them are good weightlifters too, but as you suggest, that's not what the book is about. The strong women have earned my respect in, I'd say, 10 or 12 ways. They are kind, they are determined, almost all of them have courage, perspective. And they are uniformly tough, as I wrote about Maggie and Betsy and Claire, but not rough. Mm-hmm. I wrote about my fourth grade teacher to help make that distinction between tough and rough. So they have, and for some reason, I'm a connoisseur of warmth, and I noticed that not all warm women are strong, but almost all strong women are warm, which is the ability for another person to connect with us in an unhurried, unanxious way.
Now, you are a psychiatrist.
I am a psychiatrist. I started out as a psychologist. I have a master's in psychology and taught college in Atlanta for introductory and intermediate courses for 3 years before I went off to medical school. And my training has been principally psychiatry since that time.
Mm-hmm. So how did writing this influence you in any way? I mean, did it influence you in any way? And as you were writing it as a memoir, was it cathartic?
It was cathartic and comforting, more than I expected after I began with the reflections on Betsy, Vicky. It also helped me, I would say, my appreciation came into sharper focus as I continued to write. I spent almost over 18 years putting it together, longer than I expected, and I put it down and forget it for a half a month or half a year, pick it up again. But it did, I call my 10 fingers my 10 therapists. They helped me bring into focus about strong women as I type on the keyboard in a way that I started saying, well, yeah, I kind of appreciate them, and by the end of the 18 years, David, you really appreciate strong women, and good for you for writing this story. So it helped bring into focus the original task.
Yeah. Now, you talk about some lessons that you learned from strong women, and one of them is that loving is its own reward. What do you mean by that, David?
Well, that's a new insight for myself over the last 5 or 10 years. But we don't love people to get something back from them. That often happens, and that's a bonus. But when we love somebody, we grow and struggle and learn and gasp and laugh if we really are involved with them and love them. And we're the better for it.
Mm-hmm.
I talk about that some, I think, in my book, what that's about, but I could have gone into further detail about that. But it really is a bonus that loving is its own reward.
Yeah. Now, some men say they like strong women. Others are threatened by strong women.
And many have mixed feelings about them.
Well, tell us a little bit about that. Why would somebody have mixed feelings about them?
Well, they often, a lot of the men and younger, the boys grown up with, have two fears. One is the woman they're going to end up with is strong, and the other fear is the woman they're going to end up with is not strong. And the men who do better in relationships are in tune with their mixed feelings or their ambivalence. And the ones who have come to learn and appreciate them are really the better for it.
Yeah. One of the challenges of living with a strong woman that you've talked about that I read was that sometimes living with a strong woman, a man can just let go and coast. Do you see that happen a lot?
I don't know if it happens a lot, but it certainly does happen, Vicki. The growing into the dependency model, some men start out in a dependent way and, you know, let her take care of things and never go out of it. Some start out in a dependent way and go into greater awareness. I'm not sure I want to be this way. Maybe I can be as strong as Barbara or Mary, or maybe I can try to catch up with her. I've got a learning opportunity.
Mm.
My experience has been that men don't get into psychotherapy, which is my love, as frequently as women do. Men say, if it ain't broke, don't fix it.
Don't fix it, right.
And to their partners, well, I don't need help, Barb, I'm not sick, and to which she responds, well, Howard, I'm going for help because I'm not well, or as well as I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
So there is this ambivalence that courses through men, I would say, much more than it does through women about personal change. The old chestnut is kind of humorous, is that women marry men hoping they'll change, and men marry women hoping they won't.
Right.
And I think that also applies to women wanting to change themselves. They work on their personal growth,
mm-hmm.
and have earned my respect in the process.
Mm. So when you're writing this book, what for you was the biggest key takeaway when you were talking about In Praise of Strong Women?
My biggest rewards, Vicki, I would say were love of all women, but especially of strong girls like my daughter and strong women, and appreciation of them and feeling like a very fortunate person, but also somewhat inspired to share with the world, or at least the publishing world or the readership world, that I've got a lesson to share. I wanted to share about Jerry, a young woman who drowned at our sixth grade picnic, as I discussed in the book, under circumstances that would, it's still hard to talk without getting emotional about her, but without the circumstances being clear surrounding her death for another 35 years. And so I thought, gee, David, people need to know what happened to Jerry.
Right.
This is important.
Right. Well, I know that you're coming down to Seattle this week. The book is called In Praise of Strong Women, A Psychiatrist's Memoir by David Kirkland. And let me...
Kirkpatrick.
I'm sorry, Kirkland. We have Kirkland here. Yes, David Kirkpatrick.
That's okay.
I'm so sorry.
Yeah. I'll be there April 10th at the East West Bookstore, Vicki, and then returning to Orca's store in Olympia on the 23rd, and then going down to Portland on the 24th.
Okay. And so do you know what time you'll be here? That's what I was looking for when I saw Kirkland.
I don't have the East-West time. I apologize, but they would be glad to give it to you if you give them a shout.
Okay. Well, David Kirkpatrick, I thank you so much for being with us today. And listeners, you can find him over here at East-West Books in Seattle on April 10th. Thank you so much, David.
Vicki, my appreciation. Good day.
And please stay with us when we come back. We'll be talking with Marshall Goldsmith about getting your mojo.
Do you love wildlife? Then make a real difference by helping PAWS care for sick and injured wild animals. Volunteers help feed and clean the animals until they are well enough to return to the wild. Sign up today and help save a wild life. No experience necessary. All training is provided. Visit PAWS.org or call 425-787-2500.
What's happening in 2012? Join us next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for Unplugging the Patriarchy. Lucia Rennie's work shares the experiences of three women mystics as they unite to disintegrate the 5,000-year-old patriarchy and usher in a new age of balance and expanded consciousness.
We'll also talk with novelist Diane Hammond about her new book based on Hollywood dreams, and Lisa Shannon, who journeyed into the worst place on earth to be a woman. That's all coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Do you have legal questions? Need to know where to turn?
Hi, this is Rick Gregrick, your host of Northwest Legal Compass.
Northwest Legal Compass will address your questions on a variety of legal topics, including estate planning, asset protection, real estate and business planning, and more. The legal and accounting staff of Gregrick & Associates are dedicated to providing you with superior legal and tax services. Their integrated counsel is geared to the achievement of your goals.
Visit us on the web at rjglegal.com.
Be sure and tune in every Friday at noon here on Alternative Talk 1150.
Hi, I'm Andrea Kay, America's leading career expert. I know it's going to be a great conversation when Vicki St. Clair asked me to offer my career advice on her show. Vicki asks thoughtful questions, she's thorough, she works hard to bring you great guests who walk their talk with information and solutions that can lift your career and better your life so that you'll live well, live strong. My advice? Tune into our conversations and all the interviews on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for thought-provoking insight and tips on the things that really matter in your life. And visit AndreaKay.com, that's Andrea, K-A-Y.com, for information about my books and loads of free practical advice and inspiration for your career.
Tell your friends, the place to be is Alternative Talk, 1150 AM.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair. And we're talking about mojo. We're talking about how to get it, how to keep it, how to get it back if you lose it. And my guest is Marshall Goldsmith. He has a very impressive resume. He holds an MBA from Indiana University, a PhD from UCLA. He's on the faculty at Dartmouth College's Tuck School of Business and at Alliant International University's Marshall Goldsmith School of Management. He is also the co-founder of Marshall Goldsmith Partners and the author or co-editor of 18 books. He was recognized by the American Management Association as one of 50 great thinkers and business leaders who've influenced the field of management over the last 80 years. And he's been featured in Business Week, The Economist, The New Yorker, The Wall Street Journal, and the list goes on. Marshall Goldsmith, welcome to the show.
Very happy to be here.
Well, this was a good book, and it came very appropriately, landed on my desk at a very appropriate time for me. So I thank you for that. I was listening to the news headlines yesterday, and somebody made the comment that Barack Obama and his crew have their mojo back. But tell us, for the purposes of this show and this book, what you mean by mojo.
I define mojo as that positive spirit toward what you are doing now. That starts from the inside and radiates to the outside.
And why did you write this book? Why did you think this was a book that was necessary to be on the shelves?
Well, yeah, I've written a lot of other books about interpersonal behavior. And I do these programs at my house with retiring CEOs, and we talk about what matters in life. Turns out only five things come up. There's health. Then there's wealth. But if you look at studies on happiness, after about 80,000 a year, wealth doesn't seem to matter much. Then there's relationships with people that you love. And then other than that, the only things that seem to matter are happiness and meaning. So if you look at life, if you've got enough money, you have good relationships with people you love, and you're healthy, the only question is, are you doing what makes you happy, and are you doing what's meaningful for you? The answer is yes and yes. You just won.
Right.
You are a success. I mean, I've met billionaires who are miserable. So that, to me, is the definition of success. So the book was originally designed to try to help people have happier and more meaningful lives.
Mm.
I'm a Buddhist, so I thought that was a nice thing to do. On the other hand, after I wrote the book, I started realizing it's also related to helping other people have happier and more meaningful lives that we interact with.
Yeah, Yeah, and I know that you've studied, you were an executive coach, as you said, so you have made a career study of what makes people successful, and you've noted that successful people do spend a large part of their lives engaging in activities, you say, that simultaneously provide meaning and happiness, and that's what this is all about. So, as you're writing this book, did you consider some of the challenges that have been prevalent through your life or maybe have recurred periodically throughout your life where you've lost your mojo a little?
Oh, definitely. One of the things that led to the book was a process I started using a few years ago called the daily question process. I have a daily question list I ask myself every day. I have a coach. We go over this. 24 questions every day. First question is, how happy were you yesterday on a 1 to 10 scale? How meaningful was yesterday? How many times yesterday did you try to prove you were right when it wasn't worth it?
Right.
How many angry or destructive comments did you make about people yesterday? Just a whole bunch of questions about life. How much do you weigh? Just basic questions. It's amazing how well this process works. So this process got me thinking, you know, and what I found out about doing this, even once a day is not enough. I lose it as the day progresses.
Mm-hmm.
So I have a new process where you can start looking at your life about after every activity and start really challenging yourself to say, how happy was I? How meaningful was this? So as we go through life, we don't just get lost. My favorite three lines in the book are, our default reaction in life is not to experience happiness. Our default reaction in life is not to experience meaning. Our default reaction in life is to experience inertia. We just tend to do what we've been doing, go where we've been going, see what we've been seeing. It is very hard to break the powerful spell of inertia.
It is. And we're often told, you know, be mindful, be in the present, be awake. And it can be very hard to do that when you've got phones ringing and emails you need to get to, as well as the work that you're on. And this is a great way. I love the simplicity of this, Marshall. And yet, it's a very simple tool. But you and your partner, you say, have been doing this for quite a while. And you actually stopped doing it for, I think, a year to see what kind of response, if there was any change in behavior, and you found there was. I wonder if you'd talk about that a little.
Yeah, it went straight downhill.
In a nutshell.
Straight downhill. And again, I'm not a better or worse person. There's another book out right now that kind of reinforces my point, and it's by a Dr. Atul Gawande from Harvard Medical School, and it's called The Checklist Manifesto. Pretty popular book. Anyway, I'm talking to Dr. Gawande next week about this, but his book makes a point. It's a different sort of field, but we have the same philosophy exactly. And it's very counterintuitive because he's working mostly with medical doctors. His feeling is very smart people who are engaged in highly complex work do not need simple checklists less. They need them more. Because, as you said, we're so busy, we're so focused, there's so many things going on in our lives. If we're not careful, we completely lose that sense of what matters. I have a fascinating case study with the person I'm coaching right now. He's a huge executive in a big company, and his wife has died. And, you know, I talked to him, and you know what I told him when we had lunch together? I said, you seem more sane today than I've ever seen you in your whole life. And, you know, although what's going on for him is very hard,
right,
it puts things in perspective.
Yeah.
All that little stuff that used to make you crazy, you know what you realize? It didn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
None of it was that important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I've had two experiences in my life where I experienced what I call temporary sanity. One is I went to Africa during the Great Famine Campaign of 1984 and watched lots of people starve to death with the Red Cross, and I came home and I said, you know, don't complain because the airplane's late. There are kids out there that have problems we can't even understand.
Yeah, we need to sometimes realize there are people a lot worse off than us. That's for sure.
And the other time I broke my neck surfing, I didn't know I'd ever be able to walk again. And then when I could finally walk, I was so happy. But as I said, do you notice? I said both of these were periods of temporary sanity. I was perfectly capable of becoming petty and weird and stupid within short order.
Mm.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about mojo and how we, if we're in that no-jo, as you I call it no-go because I was a little no-go for a while. We're going to talk about how we can find our mojo and get it and keep it. Please stay with us. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Marshall Goldsmith.
Do something different with your spare time. Give baby animals and Paws a fresh start. With the assistance of caring volunteers, Paws helps hundreds of orphaned and sick kittens and puppies each year. Join us and save lives. Become a Paws foster care volunteer. For more information, visit paws.org or 425-787-2500. Paws.org or 425-787-2500.
You're never too old to fulfill your dream. But sometimes we get caught at making a living instead of creating a life. If you put your dream on hold or can't figure out what to do when you grow up, tell us what's getting in your way. I'm Vicky St. Clair, and I'm excited to let you know that we've partnered with dream coach Joyce Chapman to get your questions answered on air. So tell us what's holding you back. Email your questions and challenges to info@conversationslive.net or leave a confidential voicemail at 425-269-4772. And tune into our third Monday Dream Coach series at noon Pacific on KKNW. See more information at conversationslive.net.
Let's get it started. Let's get it started.
I'm Rich Hallstrom. Join me and my co-host Tim Humphrey every Monday at 1 p.m. here on Alternative Talk 1150 for Motivation with a Purpose, where we will tell the inspiring stories of people from all walks of life. Motivation with a Purpose every Monday from 1 to 2 p.m. here on Alternative Talk 1150 a.m.
Spread the word. You don't have to settle for the usual talk radio. Now there's Alternative Talk 1150 a.m.
And welcome back. You're listening to Conversations Live with Vicky St. Clair. My guest in this segment is Marshall Goldsmith. He's one of America's leading executive coaches and is very active as a writer and speaker in the business world. His new book is called Mojo, How to Get It, How to Keep It, How to Get It Back If You've Lost It. So let's kick off this segment by Marshall by assuming I've lost my mojo. What are some things that can kill mojo?
Well, with the people I work with, and it sounds like you fell into the same trap, number one is probably overcommitment.
Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting because we have so much mojo, we're motivated, enthusiastic, we want to do more and more, that we overcommit and just get buried. And eventually it sort of backfires on us and we start losing it. So I'd say that's probably number one for the successful people I work with. Another one I talk about in the book that's a big one is sunk costs. You know, we get trapped. We get invested in doing something and we just can't get out of it.
Right.
And sometimes even things that are pretty good can do more harm than good. Early in, the biggest mistake I ever made in my career, I was told at a very young age by my mentor, he said, "You're too good at what you do. You're making too much money, you're going to run around and sell days, and you'll never make the long-term investment in research and writing that you should." And, you know, for 12 years, I lived out his prophecy.
Oh, interesting.
I just got stuck in sunk costs, doing what I was doing. I was pretty successful, but I didn't challenge myself to be better.
Yeah, I think that's a very easy trap to fall into. It's a, even though it may feel you don't want to be there, sometimes it is a comfort zone, isn't it?
It is a comfort zone, and I look at a lot of people that grew up with me, and I notice some of the ones that we had the same professional start, same PhD, same everything, and they just drifted. And they're not bad people.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're good people, and they have pretty good lives, but they really didn't do as much as they could have. They got too comfortable.
Right. Mm-hmm. So how did you get yourself out of that? When you came to that realization, hey, I'm, you know, yes, I'm very good at what I'm doing, but I'm not challenging myself enough.
Well, you know, I was very fortunate. I got to meet a woman named Frances Hesselbein, who Peter Drucker said is the greatest leader he ever met, and winner of the Presidential Medal of Freedom. And she's just a wonderful woman who kind of encouraged me to be more. I got on the board of the Peter Drucker Foundation, and I just started hanging around with people who were better than I was. Guess what? They kind of inspired me to try to do a little better.
Yeah. Now, you talk about Frances Hesselbein quite a bit. She was the chief executive officer of the Girl Scouts, right?
Yes.
What was it that made her such a unique and strong leader in your eyes?
Well, Frances Hesselbein embodies everything I talk about in the book. And remember, that I tell a story about her in the book, Carrying the Laundry. Wonderful story. I'm working at the Girl Scouts and as a volunteer, and I said I could only work on Saturday, but I got to get my laundry done. And she said, not a problem. Just put it on a pile on the floor. I'll have someone pick it up. The next morning, I'm eating breakfast with all these distinguished women, the head of Girl Scouts in L.A. and New York and Los Angeles, and we all look up. She's carrying my laundry across the floor to the laundry room.
Interesting.
Big message about leadership.
Yeah, yeah.
She could have had anybody else carry the laundry. She's the CEO. Mm. So I love her. She's one of my best friends. Two of my other great friends who were just role model leaders. One of them is Alan Mulally, who's the CEO of the Ford Motor Company. Alan, I think, is a wonderful leader. I've known him for years, always up, always positive. I've been with him during periods of high amounts of adversity. But you know what? You can never tell it through him. And also General Eric Shinseki, formerly head of the Army, who told Donald Rumsfeld the Iraq War would take lots of troops and cost money and was crucified for telling the truth. So now he's the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, just a great human being, you know, just always up and always positive. Got shot twice as a hero, and I'm sure he didn't complain either time.
Mm-hmm. So what is it, let's go back to Alan Mulally, the CEO of Ford. What is it that separates him from other CEOs?
Well, I was with him when he was at Boeing, and 9/11 occurred. Now, if you're running Boeing commercial aircraft, 9/11 is a disaster in more ways than you can even count.
Right, right.
And, you know, it had to hurt him. But you know what he said the next day? Great leaders get paid when times are tough. That's when you earn your money.
Mm.
It's showtime. And he realized that everybody was down and somebody had to carry the ball and be a leader. And that's him. Hey, I don't know if you remember, when he first went over to Ford, they weren't doing real well.
Right.
Their stock is up 10 times since he's been there.
Yeah.
Well, one of the reasons is he is always up and positive and motivated. He returns emails. And another good friend of mine is Liz Smith. She's now the CEO of a restaurant chain called OSI. They own Outback and Fleming's and all these restaurants. Liz just called Alan up and said, Alan, can you come down to Tampa and give a talk to my top 500 leaders? What did he say? Sure. That's just the way he is. You know, generous, helps people, you know, doesn't expect a lot back. Just a great guy. I was just in Seattle teaching a class at Microsoft, and one of the people in the class knew his family, grew up near him, knew his kids. He was the same age as his son, right?
Mm-hmm.
Said he was always the same way, at work, at home, never changed.
Yeah, interesting. Now, I wanted to ask you, you talk about women and their desire to get ahead in their careers, and you talk about please quit being so hard on yourself. This is something that I think women are very hard on themselves. What do you have to say about that, and how can they become better leaders by not being so hard on themselves?
Well, the first thing, I coach women. That is the number one coaching I have for women. Don't be so hard on yourself. And I teach a women's leadership class, and the basic purpose of the class is how to be happy and reduce guilt. I use a couple of examples. One example is, I say, imagine that, an example I give to women is, I say, give me one word. When my daughter grows up, I want my daughter to be. What's one word? The most common word, happy. I say, do you want your daughter to be happy? Do you want the young people who report to you to be happy? Do you want the other women who respect you to be happy? Yes. I say, you go first.
Oh, good one.
Do you want them to feel guilty?
Mm-hmm.
Do you want them to be driven? Do you want them to beat themselves over the head? And they all say no. So you know what I say? You're their role model. Quit doing it yourself. See, it's very interesting. With women, what I tell women is, you know, don't be so hard on yourself. With men, you know what I say to men? Mm-hmm. All this research on leadership shows the average woman is a better leader than the average man, but they have one more problem than men. They're too hard on themselves.
Mm-hmm.
So with women, I say, don't be so hard on yourself. With men, I say there's good news for us and bad news in this research. I say the bad news for men is we're not as good. Good news is we don't care.
Do men need to be a little harder on themselves, maybe?
Maybe they should, but they're not going to. I might be a good teacher. I'm not that good. So what I coach women on is let go of guilt and think about the role model you are for your daughters and the other women in your organization. You don't want them to be beating themselves up all the time. So don't beat yourself up all the time.
Yeah, it goes back to that, to take care of yourself first, right?
Well, it's interesting because with men, I seldom have to make the point of you need to focus on your own happiness because it's good for the rest of the world. With men, mostly they're comfortable focusing on their own happiness just because of their own happiness.
Right, right. You have a lot of tools in the book. You have some tools on the website which are really good too. And one of them is the list that you talked about at the beginning of the show, the questions that you and your friend ask each other every single day. I want to talk about taking control of your story, your reputation.
Yes.
And I think this is something that bothers a lot of people and people have difficulty. And I know myself, I have in some instances over the years stayed too long. You have a tool and you say when to stay, when to go. I wonder
right.
if you'd talk a little bit about how we can figure out in our heads, when is it time to stay? When is it time to go?
Well, I talk about, are we moving up in this organization or situation we're in, or we're moving down, and we got a choice, get pushed out or jump out, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think very important to look at both of those factors and say, where is the future in this organization? Am I moving up in this company? Am I moving down in this company? Is my status going up or down? Where is the company going? And what's my future likely to be? And let me give you a simple guideline that I have, two simple guidelines for people today. Are you ready?
Yes.
Guideline number one, I have two people who are corporate CEOs told me they would never be CEOs if I hadn't taught them this. And it's true at every level. This is 2010. It's tough out there. Before you speak and before you act, you breathe and you ask yourself one question. Is what I'm about to say or do in the best interest of myself and my family?
Mm-hmm.
The answer is no. You got to wonder why you're saying it or doing it. Bad year to get lost on ego. Very bad year to get lost in our ego. My second advice for people who are in kind of, they don't know for sure they like where they are, they're maybe going through career transition, get real offers. You go out there and bust your butt and get real offers. Face the fact that you're going to be in sales. Most great salespeople get rejected a lot. Get ready for rejection. You can't let the rejection get you down. You got to just keep trying and trying and trying until you get real offers. You can always say no to the offer,
right?
But you cannot say no to an offer you don't have.
Yeah, good advice. I think in my case, I've sometimes stayed when I'm not learning. There's nobody there that I feel I can learn from anymore.
Yeah.
And of course,
then you just start drifting.
Yeah, you feel like you're coasting. And to me, that feels like a waste of time. You know. I want to talk a little bit about the difference between professional mojo and personal mojo. We are almost at the end of the segment here, but what is the difference between personal mojo and professional mojo?
Professional mojo, that's what I'm bringing to this task. My motivation, ability, understanding, what I give to it. Personal mojo is what it gives to me. Does it make me happy? Is it rewarding for me? And historically, almost everything written about achievement has looked at only half of that equation. What are you bringing to it? Hasn't looked at the other half of the equation, which I think, by the way, is just as important. What does it bring to you?
Mm-hmm. So what if I'm, you're not saying, sometimes people say, if you're in a situation, behave this way at work and behave this way at home. You say in the book, I'm not explaining this very well, but you say in the book that it all plays together at the end of the day. If you're on a down slope at home, chances are you're going to be on a down slope at work.
Mm. By the way, that's not a theory, it's a fact.
Mm-hmm.
My daughter's Dr. Kelly Goldsmith, who's a professor at Northwestern University Kellogg School. She and I did a lot of research. 3,000 people completed a survey. You know what we found out? People's experience of happiness and meaning at work is incredibly parallel to their experience of happiness and meaning at home. The positive correlation between the percentage of time you spend at work and home on activities that simultaneously produce happiness and meaning positive 0.6.
Wow.
Database, 3,000 people, significant at the 0.000001 level, which shows that a lot of our experience of happiness and meaning is not what we're doing. It's who we are.
Yeah. So bottom line, let's get Marshall's book and get our mojo back. Tell us where people can find you, Marshall.
Several places. One, mojothebook.com. It gets the free applications. Marshall Goldsmith, and Marshall has two L's, marshallgoldsmithlibrary.com. All my articles, videos, everything's online for free. My email address is marshall@marshallgoldsmith.com.
Excellent.
I can't get back to people instantly, but I always get back to people eventually.
All right. I appreciate you being with us today. Thank you so much.
Marshall, thank you. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. Marshall Goldsmith, my guest, his book, Mojo, How to Get It, How to Keep It, How to Get It Back If You Lost It. And before I go, I want to just give a mention for Garrison Keillor. He's over at the Paramount Theater in Seattle, Washington, this coming Saturday doing a live broadcast. I went last week. It is fantastic. And his special guest this week is Nellie McKay. So if you're interested, get in touch with Paramount Theater in Seattle. And we'll be back next week with an all-new live show. Until then, live well, live strong. Thanks for being with us on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
What's happening in 2012? Join us next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair for Unplugging the Patriarchy. Lucia Reni's work shares the experiences of three women mystics as they unite to disintegrate the 5,000-year-old patriarchy and usher in a new age of balance and expanded consciousness. We'll also talk with novelist Diane Hammond about her new book based on Hollywood dreams and Lisa Shannon, who journeyed into the worst place on earth to be a woman. That's all coming next week on Conversations Live with Vicki St. Clair.
Take over, 'cause if you don't, the